The New York Times reports that federal prosecutors are preparing criminal charges that could produce the first guilty plea from the leadership of a major bank in more than two decades. If that happens, it will puncture the popular belief, confirmed through the financial crisis, that Wall Street institutions have grown so important to the economy they cannot be charged. A lack of criminal prosecutions during the Obama administration has contributed to the perception that Wall Street giants are too big to jail. Journalist Matt Taibbi says it's not just perception, it's real. There's one system of justice for the wealthy and one for everyone else. Matt Taibbi joins us after the news from NPR. And welcome back to Midday, everyone. Dan Rodericks here. Thanks again for joining us. The nation's wealth gap, that is, by most common measures, the difference in income between the top 1% or 5% and everyone else, has continued to widen over the last 35 years. Aside from the disparity in the standard of living between the richest 1% of Americans and the rest of us, there are other consequences of such a wide gap between rich and poor, notably in the American criminal justice system. My guest this hour wrote for several years for Rolling Stone magazine about national political and economic affairs. In Matt Taibbi's new book, The Divide, American Injustice in the Age of the Wealth Gap, he examines the vastly different experiences the rich and poor have when dealing with American police and prosecutors. As violent crime has been on a steady decline for the past two decades, why, Matt Taibbi wonders, have incarceration rates among the poorest Americans exploded during the same period? Meanwhile, Wall Street executives directly responsible for the 2008 global financial crisis have walked away from criminal charges, even earning bonuses in some cases, and prosecutors seem unable to bring high-profile white-collar criminals to justice. It's my pleasure to welcome to Midday Matt Taibbi. This is his sixth book, The Divide. Matt, so great to have you on the show. It's nice to finally get to talk to you.
Oh, thanks for having me on.
Let me read something here from the book. I wanted to start with this because some people, they hear the premise of your book and the premise of our discussion, and they say, so what else is new? The rich get richer, the poor get poorer, and there's always been a different system of justice for the two. But you write, you say, this goes far beyond the oft-quoted liberal cliche about how we now have two Americas, one for the rich and one for the poor, with different sets of laws and different levels of punishment, or more to the point, non-punishment for each. The rich have always gotten breaks, and the poor have always had to swim upstream. The new truth is darker and more twisted. So take it from there, Matt.
Well, there's a couple of things going on. Number one, this process is accelerating to a significant degree. And you alluded to some of that in just some of the statistics that you quoted at the top of the show. Violent crime has gone down 44% since 1990, but the prison population has more than doubled during that time. So we've gone from having about a million people behind bars to having somewhere between 2.2 and 2.3 million. And interestingly, we've also seen a quadrupling of that same prison population since 1980. So this goes back quite a while. But to me, the really interesting point is that in recent years, and particularly in the wake of the 2008 financial crisis, we've seen just a total absence of high-level prosecutions. Whereas in the wake of the SNL crisis, for instance, we brought over 1,000 cases. We put about 800 people in jail. In the next big round of scandals with the accounting scandals of the early 2000s, late 90s, we pushed criminal cases against all the major offenders, Enron, Adelphia, Tyco, WorldCom. And what's different now is that we seem to no longer think it necessary to at least keep up appearances in terms of making these symbolic prosecutions. And so that's why that's why I thought this was a worthwhile topic to dwell upon, because something a little bit different is happening with an old story.
There's a New York Times story from April 29th that, as mm-hmm. I was preparing for our conversation today, I was struck by this story, and I was reading this and thinking, is this happening because of Taibbi? let me just read this to you. I find it almost uncanny, sure. Some of the prose, even in this New York Times account of this. Under the mm-hmm. headline, two giant banks seen as immune become targets. Federal prosecutors are nearing criminal charges against some of the world's biggest banks, a development that could produce the first guilty plea from a major bank in more than two decades. In doing so, prosecutors are confronting the popular belief that Wall Street institutions have grown so important to the economy that they cannot be charged. A lack of criminal prosecutions of banks and their leaders fueled a public outcry over the perception that Wall Street giants are too big to jail. Addressing those concerns, prosecutors in Washington and New York have met with regulators about how to criminally punish banks without putting them out of business and damaging the economy, which I just find this kind of amazing. This, of course, this story speaks to Credit Suisse and mm-hmm. BNP Paribas, which is France's largest bank. We can get into that in a minute. But, I mean, you must be struck by this as well. Like, this is exactly what you're writing about, this whole idea that the Justice Department won't even approach the question of prosecution because of concerns about damage to the economy.
Sure, and I've even seen some news stories already come out that have contrasted the approach in this case with the approach towards HSBC and to UBS, which mm-hmm. were banks that I wrote about a lot in this book, and the non-prosecutions of those companies were, I thought, glaring examples of this phenomenon of no longer enforcing a certain kind of white-collar offense. But nobody will be happier than me if my book turns out to be wrong and all of this becomes irrelevant and the Obama administration follows through on its promises to clean up Wall Street. I think that would be a great development, and whatever the reason for it, and it can't be in response to, you know, to any one writer. I think this has sort of been in the ether, and there's a lot of people writing about this now. You know, Elizabeth Warren's book is out. There's that book Capital that's out. There's Michael Lewis's book. It's just something that people are thinking about, and I imagine that they're sensitive to all kinds of criticism coming from many quarters about the glaring lack of a response to the corruption on Wall Street.
There's an audio clip I want to air for you. This is Eric Holder, the Attorney General of the United States, in a 2013 testimony to the Senate Judiciary Committee. Now, Republican Senator Chuck Grassley asks Holder to explain the light treatment of HSBC, the bank you just referred to, HSBC, mm-hmm. which admitted to consorting with groups associated with terrorism and drug trafficking.
Mm-hmm. I am concerned that the size of some of these institutions becomes so large that it does become difficult for us to prosecute them when we are hit with indications that if you do prosecute, if you do bring a criminal charge, it will have a negative impact on the national economy, perhaps even the world economy. And I think that is a function of the fact that some of these institutions have become too large. Now, again, I'm not talking about HSBC. This is just a more general comment. I think it has an inhibiting influence on, in impact on our ability to bring resolutions that I think would be more appropriate. And I think that is something that you all need to consider. So the concern that you raised is actually one that I share.
Okay, Matt, let's go over this a little bit. Prosecutors are required to weigh the broader implications or the economic consequences of charging these big banks, big corporations, right?
They may weigh them, yeah.
They may weigh them. Well, mm-hmm. what are the guidelines exactly? I mean, under Holder and this Justice Department.
So, specifically, Eric Holder, way back in 1999, when he was a deputy attorney general in the Clinton administration, he wrote a memo that's come to be known as the Holder Memo that outlined a policy called collateral consequences, which basically just says exactly what he just said, that if you're worried about prosecuting a company that is systemically important, and you're worried about the ramifications of that. Now, way back then, he was talking about the implications for, say, innocent executives who weren't part of the wrongdoing, or shareholders, or other people who might be affected by, you know, say, the collapse of a big company.
Mm-hmm.
But now, in the age of too big to fail, he's also talking about the potential impact a criminal charge against a company like this might have on the economy at large. And this is something that we saw very graphically in 2008 when, for instance, Lehman Brothers collapsed. That set off a chain reaction of all kinds of horribleness. And understandably, they're anxious to avoid that. And I completely understand that. And I actually agree with most of what he's saying. I just think that they can really only use that rationale once. If a company is too big to prosecute, they have to take steps to make it smaller, first of all. And then secondly, I just don't see how they can continue morally putting people in jail for lesser, say, drug offenses when you're not criminally prosecuting people for laundering, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars for drug cartels.
Okay. I mean, I see your point, and, you know, I agree with you. But someone else listening would say the other resolutions that Holder is suggesting there, you know, huge damages, multi-billion dollar damages from, say, J.P. Morgan Chase.
Mm-hmm.
What's wrong with that? Isn't that a good enough resolution?
Not to me, not to the person who's sitting in jail for slinging a bag of dope on the corner. I mean, it may make sense in a vacuum. There may be merit to that argument, but in order to make that argument, one has to concede what it admits, and what it admits is that we have one system of justice for a person who commits an act within the confines of a large, systemically important financial institution, and there's another set of consequences for somebody who commits more or less the same crime on the street at a lower level. And it's frustrating to me that the consequence for the person on the street is significantly more serious than it is for the person who commits the crime within the confines of the institution, for a couple of reasons. Number one, typically, that person isn't doing it out of need. These are what I'd like to think of as crimes of intellectual choice. People who are in a company like HSBC and they choose to launder money for X, Y, and Z malefactor, do they have to do that? I mean, is that something that they need to do in order to put money, you know, put food in their table to feed their kids? I doubt it. I think we should punish, if anything, more harshly that kind of offender.
So this is very interesting to me because I think there's a perception. I'm going to just sort of speculate on what my fellow Americans think as they sit
Sure.
around the dinner table talking about these things. There's a different aesthetic of the crime. One crime that someone's on the street, it's a nuisance crime, or it's even a violent crime, maybe, even though violent crime has gone down. People see that. That's what they see as crime. At this white-collar mm-hmm. level, when you're talking about financial institutions and banks, people think that they made a series of bad bets, so they made a series of bad choices, that they screwed up, basically, that there wasn't evil or criminal intent. And that's just an impression I have that I'm speculating on what Americans
Sure.
think, how they divide these things in terms of their thinking. Do you agree that could be the perception that people have?
That's absolutely the perception that people have, and they get that perception for a reason, because they're very frequently told that is in fact the case. President Obama himself, in an interview with 60 Minutes. Made a very heavily parsed statement that some of the worst behavior on Wall Street was not illegal, that it was merely greedy. Now, he didn't say all of it wasn't illegal, and he didn't say all of it was legal, but he did say that some of it wasn't illegal, per se. And this fuels this and other comments that you one often hears from the financial services sector, where people say, well, what happened may have been greedy, it may have been unethical, but it wasn't criminal. This ends up in sort of the ether, and people hear it and they accept it. But that's only because they don't understand what went on. Many of the things that have taken place since before 2008 and extending up to the present are just huge scale versions of the same kinds of crimes that ordinary people are convicted for on a day-to-day basis. You know, you look at somebody who gets caught for welfare fraud, for instance. You know, you can suffer all kinds of consequences for that. Your custody of your children may become imperiled. You may lose access to future benefits. You may even do jail time. Whereas fraud on a much huger scale, and it definitely was criminal fraud. The subprime mortgage crisis was all about people who were taking assets that they knew to be of very poor quality, disguising them as highly rated investments, and then selling them off to investors all around the world. No different than selling a phony Prada handbag or a phony Rolex watch. They were selling phony AAA rated mortgages to institutional investors. That's fraud. We've seen lately the LIBOR scandal, which is market manipulation. The HSBC case was money laundering for drug dealers. We've seen bribery. We've seen every kind of crime that a bank can possibly commit, and these are crimes. It's important for people to understand that they're not just coloring outside the lines a little bit. This is stuff that there should be consequences for.
The rich have always gotten breaks and the poor have always had to swim upstream. The new truth is darker and more twisted. The new truth is a sci-fi movie, a dystopia. And in this sci-fi world, the issues aren't justice and injustice, but biology and mortality. We have a giant meat-grinding bureaucracy that literally alters the physical makeup of its citizens, systematically grinding down the losers into a smaller, meeker, lower race of animal, while aggrandizing the winners, making them bigger than life, impervious super people. Quoting there from Matt Taibbi's latest book, The Divide, American Injustice in the Age of the Wealth Gap. Matt, our guest in this hour of midday. We're going to take our first break here. We'll come back and talk some more about The Divide. Welcome back. Dan Rodrigues here. The phone number for midday, 410-662-8780. Toll-free long distance, 866-661-9309. The midday email address, midday@wypr.org. Back with Matt Taibbi. Pleasure of speaking to Matt about his sixth book, The Divide. It's just out this month, American Injustice in the Age of the Wealth Gap. And I want to go to the other side of things, Matt, and then we'll take some phone calls here in a minute. But, you know, you spent a lot of time in New York and looking at the justice system there on the street among some average Americans, some very poor Americans. And I wanted a couple of names I'm going to throw at you, and I thought you could just talk about this a little bit, to contrast it with what's been happening between the Justice Department and Wall Street. Mm-hmm. Tory Marone, or Maroney.
Yeah.
Tory, young white guy, described as sort of halfway homeless. You find him in New York. What happened to him?
So this was on the day of the HSBC announcement. I was covering that story for Rolling Stone, the HSBC story, and I remember the Justice Department announced the settlement in New York that day. And having known that HSBC had already on multiple occasions been sort of caught by the federal government having lax money laundering procedures, and I was expecting a very draconian settlement out of them. And when I heard that it was just a fine, it was a big fine, but that no, there was not going to be any jail time, that no individuals would have to pay, I immediately thought to run down to the courthouse that day, and I asked around a bunch of public defenders, and I said, you know, what's the dumbest drug case that you had today? And a bunch of people pointed me in the direction of this guy, Tory. who, as it turned out, he basically had fallen asleep in a park, and that was the source of his original arrest, is that he wouldn't leave a, he was in a park after dark. Subsequently, he got stopped in a stop and frisk. They found a joint in his pocket, and even though that's technically decriminalized in New York City, in stop and frisk, they can make you empty your pockets, at which point you're no longer concealing your marijuana, at which point it becomes a crime. There were 50,000 such arrests in New York that year. So Tory got 47 days in Rikers. And I just told this story to contrast it with HSBC. Again, here's a person who is at the lowest level of the illegal drugs business. He couldn't possibly be less of an important figure in the international crime scheme. He's just a guy walking the streets a little bit high, who's got a joint in his pocket, and he gets time in jail, whereas people who were enabling the worst and most violent drug traffickers in the world get a walk. And I know it's not the most perfect comparison, and I've had people tell me that's a forced comparison, but, you know, I forced it. I mean, I think it's a valid comparison to make.
Now we get to Andre Brown, and that brings up the topic you just mentioned, stop and frisk. And frisk, of course, been touted first by Mayor Giuliani and then by Mayor Bloomberg and defended in federal court, as being the reason why New York City is so much safer today. But tell us about Andrew Brown.
Andrew, yeah. So Andrew's a guy. He's a 35-year-old African-American bus driver who I met in a law office. And we just got to talking, and I asked him what he was there for, and he told me that he had been arrested for obstructing pedestrian traffic. And again, there's a subtext of sort of white guilt that kind of runs through this whole book, because there are all kinds of things that I just didn't know go on all around, that were going on all around me as a citizen of New York, as a journalist. I was sort of ashamed that I didn't know this, but apparently being arrested for refusing to obey a police order or obstructing pedestrian traffic, which basically just means standing on the street, is a fairly common thing to get hauled in for. I believe you had a city councilman down there in Baltimore who was talking about a similar problem, calling it an epidemic of false arrest. Basically, these stats-based police, I'm sorry, not in Baltimore, but basically these statistics-based police programs, the idea of them is to bring in as many people as possible, and they're looking for guns, drugs, and warrants. And if they don't find them, they're supposed to theoretically throw them back. But what they often do instead is they press forward with these ridiculous cases. And it can be for anything. It can be for having an open container. It can be for standing in the wrong place on the sidewalk. It can be for riding your bicycle the wrong way down the sidewalk. And I watched that year, there were 600,000 of these sort of silly summonses that were written for New Yorkers, almost all of them non-white. And they all involved these kinds of silly offenses where police, they're looking for something more serious. When they don't find it, they just write you up for whatever. And Andrew fell under the category of whatever.
You know, your reference to Baltimore actually is right on. In the previous administration here, under a different mayor, we had basically followed the New York model. The New York model was brought here, a zero-tolerance idea, arresting people, clearing street corners for quality-of-life crimes, so to speak.
Right.
Littering, urinating, things like that. And we had months with 10,000 arrests. We had years with 100,000 arrests. The city has since had to settle a case over that, and it cost them lots of money. So we've had that experiment here too. It's filled our jails, filled our prisons. We now lead the world in incarceration in the United States. This country is a world leader when it comes to jailing our citizens. Matt Taibbi is our guest. His book is The Divide: American Injustice in the Age of the Wealth Gap. Matt, I want to take a couple of calls and hear from our listeners during this hour.
Sure.
With you. This is Dennis in Baltimore with a question for Matt Taibbi.
Hi, Mr. Rodgers. Hi, Mr. Taibbi. How are you doing?
Good.
How are you?
I'm great. Mr. Saib, you're one of my favorite writers of all time. I especially hold on high your September 2010 article that went to work on the Tea Party. The line in the article about the man in Kentucky at the rally who said, "Keep your government hands off my Medicare," just still sticks out as one of my favorites.
Yeah, right.
Yeah. I had two quick questions, if you'd indulge me. The first sure. is, given the tight ties between campaign finance and Wall Street, do you actually see any reforms on the horizon? And the second one is more of a devil's advocate question. You noted the correlation between a decrease nationwide in violent crime, but an increase in incarceration. And I'm wondering if the increasing if it's possible that the increase in incarceration could have led to the decrease in violent crime. And I'll listen for your answer. Thanks again for everything you're doing.
Let's start with that second part of that question. The second question. Yeah,
sure.
Yeah, because I know. Thank you, Dennis. I know. You know, some people say, "Well, sure." Violent crime fell because we put more people in prison.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, I've heard that argument made. I talk to a lot of people who are criminologists who studied the statistics, and most of them were very reluctant to give the kind of broken windows style of statistics-based policing credit for the drop in crime, which almost everybody says began prior to the implementation of all these programs. A lot of people attribute it to cultural factors, that certain new types of immigrant groups are simply less prone to committing certain types of crimes, that maybe certain neighborhoods are tighter knit than they were before. Other people actually have different theories involving, you know, the lack of leaded gasoline in the air, believe it or not, is another mm-hmm. reason that I've heard. But let's be fair about it. It may very well have been one of the factors that has led to less violent crime. Certainly, when you have a community of people who are under the constant supervision of the police and are constantly interacting with the police, you're going to have more arrests and you're going to have more convictions. There's no question about that. So it would be, I think, naive to deny that those policies had some kind of effect on that. But most people still do believe that it's a kind of statistical mystery, the drop in crime, that it's not solely attributed to that.
In 1991, there were 758 violent crimes for every 100,000 people. In 2010, it was 425. We also have another factor that you mentioned, a trend that you point to, is poverty rate. Poverty rates were low and dropping in the 1990s, and by 2000, it was around 10%. Now we're up past 15%, I believe. I think in some states it's 18, 19, 20%.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And you would expect crime rates to go up in that circumstance, but actually just the opposite is going on. And who knows? Maybe it is increased policing. That might be a factor. Certainly I think that those three sets of parameters, statistical parameters, they're all counterintuitive when you put them all together. That poverty has gone up, the incarceration rate has gone up, and crime has gone down. That none of those things to me seem to make a lot of sense. They may make political sense if they're part of some other kind of initiative, but solely on their own, I even after years of research, I couldn't quite put my finger on what all those numbers mean.
Mm-hmm. Now, you know, the trend that I'm sure you're aware of here is a sort of the political influence on our correction system, our criminal justice
sure.
system, right? I mean, you had Democrats joining with the Republicans over the years to get their anti-crime, tough-on-crime bona fides by calling for more arrests, more zero-tolerance policing, longer jail terms, mandatory minimums, more people mm-hmm. held in prison for, you know, the minor drug offenses that you described earlier. So that's as a consequence of all that, we have this high incarceration rate. The reason I bring up poverty is because if you have people already poor being arrested, spending time in prison takes them away from whatever family network they have. It probably leads to even more poverty among children. And then you have the consequences of incarceration after incarceration, when people,
oh, yeah.
mostly men, mostly black men, emerge from prison. Right. And then the road back to whatever, or the road to a better life, is much more difficult for this end of the socioeconomic spectrum than it is for the folks who wear white collars to work.
Yeah, and this is why it's so important that very often in the white collar arena, you will see a settlement and an enormous amount of money will change hands. A company may hand over $500 million, but in the settlement, it will say something about how the firm does not have to either admit or deny wrongdoing. And this is important because no individual ends up having that scarlet letter attached to his or her back. You walk away from committing some kind of offense, and you're basically back at square one. Whereas if you get out of prison with a criminal record, your life has changed forever. Your voting rights may be different. Your ability to get a professional license in all a huge range of fields is affected. I mean, I found a state where they actually train prisoners how to cut hair, but when you get out of jail, you can't get a barber's license. States where you can't work in a pet cemetery when you get out. I mean, it's very, very difficult to navigate the world when you get out of jail and you have a criminal record. And this, to me, is another collateral consequence that we just don't think a whole lot about, or at least that people in positions of responsibility don't think enough about.
Maryland has made some improvements in recidivism, but generally in the nation, the recidivism was hitting 50-60%, as high as 60%, maybe 70% in some states. That is, inmates released from prison, returning to prison to the correction system within 3 years after their release, because they can't get a job, because it's a revolving door.
Mm-hmm. You can't get a job. You can't get credit. I mean, just the think about all the different consequences that are going to befall you if you have a criminal record. Now, in many cases, this may be deserved. I mean, you may have committed a very serious crime, and nobody should make it easy for you when you get out of jail. But in many cases, these are nonviolent drug offenses, usually involving very young non-white people who were simply, in many cases, taking the only available paying job in their neighborhoods, and they end up behind bars for it, and they suffer extraordinary consequences going forward. Moreover, this whole statistics-based policing strategy, very often just being under suspicion of a certain kind of crime results in consequences. I mean, I interviewed people for this book who were arrested on trumped up charges of suspicion of possessing marijuana, because the police said in one case that they thought they smelled the odor of marijuana coming from a car in the middle of winter where the windows were rolled up. Well, you'd laugh at a case like that, except that the person in the car was applying for a job as a driver at the MTA here in New York, and now he's not going to get that job because you can't have a drug charge hanging over you when you're looking for a state job. So there are all kinds of consequences that are attached to just even being accused of a crime that people don't think about.
So here we are talking about one sector of society facing the criminal justice system. And we could contrast it with the other realm that you're dealing with in your book, The Divide, except in that realm, in terms of folks responsible for the 2007-2008 global financial crisis, we don't have any, except for Bernie Madoff, although he has a different set of crimes. We don't have a good example to contrast them with.
Right. Yeah, it's what they call in baseball stat world an SSS, a small sample size.
Right. Very small.
very small. Yeah, there really aren't any cases.
Is anything going to be done?
Settlements.
So here's a question for you, Matt, from Jeff, one of our listeners. So will anything really be done? Big fines seem almost meaningless, just a cost of doing business. In prosecuting the banks, wouldn't it send a valuable message to lock up some of the top guys, the responsible ones? One could imagine that this might be a powerful deterrent.
Yeah, no, that's a great question. I'm sorry, what was the question?
Will anything really be done?
Yeah, so interestingly, when I was writing this book, I sort of came across the question, why do we put people in jail? I didn't know the answer to that question. So I started calling around law professors and prosecutors, and I asked, and it turns out that there's kind of a consistent answer that you get, and that there are three reasons. One is deterrence for the individual. In other words, you put a person in jail, that person's not going to commit a crime while he or she is in jail, and maybe not even after he or she gets out. Then there's deterrence to the group. In other words, people who are like that person in that person's cultural group may be deterred by the message sent to that individual. And then the third thing is justice for victims, which speaks for itself. But the important thing is that deterrence, in those first two types of deterrence, jail is a powerful, powerful deterrent for this type of offender, and it may not be for the kind of person who is used to going in and out of jail on drug charges. But guaranteed, if you start putting people in jails for crimes like subprime mortgage fraud or creating billions of dollars in fraudulent mortgage-backed securities and selling them off to pension funds, that would indeed have a powerful effect on behavior in the street. And we've already seen this, that the failure to do so has led to even more serious kinds of offenses like the manipulation of LIBOR, world interest
rates. Right. But you have, at least in this country, a Justice Department that fears doing this because of the repercussions of punishing large financial institutions because they've grown so big that disrupting their operations would harm the world economy, the nation's economy, the world economy. But that assumes that somebody else couldn't come along to take the CEO's position or the manager of some fund's position and keep things rolling.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I just don't buy that argument. It's kind of a butterfly effect argument of criminal justice. Like, if we flap our judicial wings over here and make an arrest, we just don't know what's going to happen on the other side of the world if we follow through. And I don't buy it. I mean, if you go back and look, when we rushed in and kind of famously did a perp walk of the CEO of Adelphia, John Regas, who was at the time 72 years old, he was one of the people and caught up in those accounting scandals in the early 2000s. The market saw its second biggest one-day gain ever on the news of the Regas arrest because of the perception that we were cleaning up a corrupt sector of the economy. And the failure to do so, I think, has actually resulted in a lack of confidence in the American financial services sector. And while I agree that it's an unknown, we don't know what would happen if we were to proceed against a big company like HSBC. I don't agree that wholeheartedly that it would all necessarily be negative. It may be a positive consequence. We don't know.
Matt Taibbi is our guest, a longtime contributing editor for Rolling Stone, the author of five previous books, including The Great Derangement and Griftopia, which were bestsellers, now out with The Divide, American Injustice in the Age of the Wealth Gap. This is Midday. A short break, and we'll talk some more with Matt. Back with Matt Taibbi. Matt, you've left Rolling Stone. What's your next project?
So I'm with First Look Media, which is the company founded by eBay founder Pierre Omidyar, who earlier this year hired Glenn Greenwald and noted investigative reporters and filmmakers like Jeremy Scahill and Laura Poitras. And they already have a site up called The Intercept that's kind of focused on national security issues. And they're very busy sort of releasing documents connected to the Snowden scandal. Mm-hmm. And I was sort of brought in to start up the second online publication. And it's as yet unnamed, but I can tell you that it's going to be sort of a humor satire type of publication with a little bit of investigative reporting mixed in. We announced our first hire yesterday, Alex Perrine from Salon.com, which is a really, really funny young writer. So We're gonna have a. It's gonna be fun. I think
it does sound like fun.
The campaign season. Yeah, it's gonna be a cool thing. So I'm psyched for it.
Good for you, Matt. Matt Taibbi's new book is "The Divide: American Injustice in the Age of the Wealth Gap." A couple of phone calls here, and then I have another question for Matt. We'll go to Dale, who's over in Greenmount West, calling midday. Hi, Dale.
Hey, how you doing, Dan? And hey, Matt, how you doing?
Good.
Hey,
all right. How are you?
I'll be real quick. I really think that you might have missed the mark on this, because I really think that most people should know that most of those convictions were in state court.
Mm-hmm.
And the state courts are what's filling up. But the comment that I was going to make...
Well, the federal prisons are filling up, too. The federal prisons are full of lots of... the federal focus has shifted to crimes of violence, drug dealing, stuff like that. You know, you don't have a lot of federal white-collar prosecutions, especially in this district in Maryland.
Yeah, but most of those convictions are done in state court. But what I was going to say is that I think that the Justice Department, you know, a lot of those lawyers left and started working for the other side, and mm-hmm. that the Attorney General had to, you know, build a deeper a bench of lawyers that would get the convictions against these other companies that have great lawyers. And I don't think it's a big story that rich people have more due process than poor people.
Oh, you don't, Dale. You don't.
A lot of news.
Dale doesn't think that. Okay, Matt, I'll let you rehabilitate Dale's view on this.
No. Look, I agree with Dale, and he's right that it's not an apples to apples comparison. Most of the really truly repressive stuff does happen in state court, and in fact, this is an argument I heard over and over again from federal prosecutors. Why are you giving me a hard time about all these stupid drug cases that are happening at the state level? I have nothing to do with that. I'm a federal prosecutor. My point about that is that if you know that hundreds of thousands or millions of people are being thrown in jail for stupid offenses at the state level, then you have a moral responsibility as a federal prosecutor to not let a wealthy offender off with a fine. I just, especially one who commits exactly the same offense as those people who are being kind of ground up in this mindless bureaucracy of the state courts. HSBC being a classic example. If you're going to let somebody at the top of the illegal drugs game off with a total walk, you can't do that if you know that thousands and thousands of people are going to real jail and state courts for much lesser offenses. So I understand that it's not the same, and that there's a difference between state courts and federal courts. I recognize that. But I do think that morally it's all connected.
The federal prosecutors have joined with the state and local prosecutors in going after criminals. You know, the federal prisons are full of are as full as the state prisons are. So there's
sure.
That. They just don't have the people that you're talking about. And they also have he's right that the financial institutions have much better have lawyers. They can pay to afford criminal defense attorneys that, you know, what they even have lobbyists, too. They have lobbyists at Work Washington, Work the Regulators. They keep their they've kept their banks in business.
But that's just all the more reason why you have to make a point of making those cases, because what happens in bureaucracies is that bureaucrats naturally gravitate to what's easiest. And if it's just easier to put the street offender in jail and it's too inherently problematic to go after the phalanx of lawyers that, you know, bank X, Y, or Z is going to throw up in your way when you try to prosecute that company, well, then is that a good reason to not go after the latter group of offenders? I don't think so. I think you have to try to administer justice as equally as possible, even though it may be difficult for you. And I get that it is difficult.
That argument that Holder makes before Congress, that works. You know, it's that butterfly effect. You just can't go into this without considering the consequences for the wider economy.
Right. Well, for me, what's troubling about that is that it's within the Justice Department's power to do something about that. Because I think if they catch a company cold like that, they can say to them, look, as a in exchange for us not tossing you all in jail right now, we'd like you to sell off some of your divisions so that we don't have to deal with this problem of you being too big to jail next time. And they have the power to do that, although I think what they would rather do is wait for Congress to make that move and to break up these too big to fail companies.
Wait for that to happen at post Citizens United and post this recent McCutcheon ruling by the Supreme Court.
Right, exactly. Yeah. The influence is only going to get worse. So, if it were Elliot Ness, if it were, that kind of a person who is in that position, I think they would want to, use that bully pulpit a little bit more, and they just haven't used it.
Here's an email comment from Christopher in Baltimore referring to Iceland. He said Iceland had a financial crisis very similar to ours about the same time. They did prosecute and jail the bankers who were responsible for causing the crisis that restored confidence in the country's banking system, and their country's economy is back to pre-crisis levels again. Their recovery was much faster than ours. Interesting. Mm-hmm. I have to look into that. A couple of comments from listeners here. Emmanuel in Baltimore and then Bill. Go ahead, Emmanuel.
Yes, how you doing? Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I agree with your guest that you have to set an example, and if you start in on these people, you have to really go at them like a tornado, because the spinoff of not dealing with them, has created, these people taking profits off the top of the stock market, these new flash boys. I mean, it seems like there's no end to what that bureaucracy can do with people's money and people's well-being, because they don't seem to look forward to being penalized for anything that they do.
Yeah, that's exactly what I was talking about before. Mm-hmm. If you don't move against them for what they did in, let's say, prior to 2008, which was a complicated but understandable kind of fraud scheme, the subprime mortgage scheme. What's the next step? If they know there's not going to be consequences for that, the next thing you're going to see is more complex and more far-reaching sorts of criminal schemes. Now, the Flash Boys thing you're talking about, which is essentially computerized insider trading. I mean, mm-hmm. we don't have to, mince words with that. The LIBOR scandal, which is basically price fixing. I mean, I lived in Russia for 10 years, just to give you an example. And I remember if you went around the city on any given day, the price of a watermelon was always the same, no matter where you went in any corner of Moscow that day, because the gangsters would get together in the morning and decide what the price of watermelons would be. Well, that's what happens when banks get together and they decide what interest rates are going to be. I mean, except the only difference is it affects, $400 trillion worth of financial products when they do it, as opposed to just watermelons. So you're absolutely right. You got to do it, or else we're going to see worse stuff.
Hey, let's let Bill have the last word here. Bill, thanks for holding, and we've only got about a minute, so go ahead.
Well, 1 minute's not going to do it, but the question is, why as a nation do we put up with this incarceration policy, which really does not significantly deter crime?
I think that's a great question. I think the reason we put up with it is because most people can't see it. It's behind bars. I think it's a massive human rights crisis that we have in this country. I mean, we have far too many people behind bars or under government supervision. The problem is the people who are being targeted, for the most part, don't have a lobby. And the problem basically remains hidden. It's just not in the news and it's not on people's minds.
Matt, thank you for making time for us here at WYPR.
Nice, thank you so much for having me
nice,
on.
Nice to get to finally speak with you. Appreciate your work over the years, especially Griftopia. And now the new The Divide, American Injustice in the Age of the Wealth Gap by Matt Taibbi, who's been our guest in this hour of midday. The publisher is Spiegel & Grau, right?
Yep, absolutely. That's right, Dan.
Okay. Matt, thanks very much.
Thank you, and let's hope we can meet up someday.
Okay. Yeah, come to Baltimore and visit us.
All right, will do.
All right. Bye-bye. That's our midday for today, folks. Dan Rodrigues here for our staff, our director, Matt Taka, today. And thank you for tuning in. We'll see you again soon.